Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for Friday the 13th of March. I'm Jane Hill. Tonight there is criticism of the US decision to ease some of its sanctions on Russian oil in an attempt to tackle surging energy costs. We'll have reaction from Moscow and Washington. With the US-Israel war on Iran almost 2 weeks old, we're assessing the state of British public opinion about the conflict and its impact across the Middle East. And it's the Oscars on Sunday. Just how dirty can the race get for a golden statuette? Two keen observers of the film industry will tell us. In the last hour or so, there have been reports out of the US that the Pentagon is preparing to send thousands more Marines to the Middle East as the war with Iran enters its third week. It's not clear how they'll be deployed, though President Trump did say today that the Islamic Republic will be hit very hard, as he put it, over the next week. We'll get more on this from our correspondent in Washington shortly. But we'll start our programme by hearing more about that decision by the Trump administration to ease sanctions on some Russian oil in an attempt to rein in soaring energy prices caused by the war with Iran. The US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent insisted it was a short-term measure aimed at promoting stability in global energy markets. It's certainly an acknowledgement that US consumers are being hit hard at the petrol pumps. President Trump has been speaking on the podcast The Brian Kilmeade Show. He is a Fox News presenter. Donald Trump told him that once the war was finished, prices would fall.
When it's over, and I don't think it's going to be long, when it's over, this is going to bounce right back so fast.
When are you going to know when it's over?
When I feel it.
Okay.
I feel it in my bones.
Well, European leaders have strongly criticised the loosening of sanctions, saying the move will fuel Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine. President Zelensky argued it could grant Moscow an extra $10 billion a month. How has the Kremlin responded to the news of the loosening? A question I put to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, in Moscow.
Well, the Russians are very pleased about this, very pleased indeed. And you can understand why, because since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 4 years ago, literally thousands and thousands of international sanctions have been imposed on Moscow. So the easing of sanctions on Russian oil, however limited and however temporary that is, and the Americans claim it is temporary and limited, that is welcome news for the Kremlin. I say temporary, but actually the Russians will have heard and been encouraged by what Donald Trump said a few days ago. He said, we have sanctions on some countries. We're going to take those sanctions off until this straightens out. Then who knows? Maybe we won't have to put them on. There'll be so much peace. So I'm sure that they will have heard that in the Kremlin. So, yeah, a positive response. Of course, the other piece of very good news for Vladimir Putin is that oil prices are so high right now because of the Iran war. And this is already generating a lot of extra money, a lot of extra revenue for Russia at a time when the Russian economy had been under intense pressure. You know, after 4 years of war and 4 years of sanctions, very serious structural problems. The budget deficit has been rising, investment falling. The authorities had to put up taxes to raise more money for the war. So more money from oil means more resources and a bigger war chest for Russia to continue its war in Ukraine.
Yes, as Volodymyr Zelensky has been reflecting today. And it's all a reminder that Russia has much to gain, really, from the war in Iran.
Yeah, it's interesting. On the one hand, President Putin has called for de-escalation in the Gulf and the Middle East. On the other hand, a protracted period of instability and high oil prices has financial benefits, undoubtedly, for Russia. The other opportunity, I think, that Russia sees from what's happening right now with the Iran war is the Russians are sort of positioning themselves, portraying themselves as international peacemakers, as global diplomats, trying to offer their service as mediators and boost their profile and their influence, actually, in the Gulf and the Middle East. So they see opportunities there. Also, they see opportunities to strengthen the relationship with the Trump administration. And this is key for Vladimir Putin. Yeah, this is why we haven't heard Vladimir Putin publicly, personally criticising Donald Trump over the Iran war. We've heard it from the foreign ministry. We've heard it from Russian commentators. One Russian newspaper this week said that Donald Trump had lost his mind. But we haven't heard that kind of language from the president. And that is because I think he believes that the relationship with the Trump administration is actually potentially very beneficial to Russia's war aims in Ukraine. And so he wants to retain a good relationship.
Mm, interesting. And the fact that international attention is focused so much on the Middle East. I mean, people forget about the war in Ukraine, or attention is not focused on Ukraine in the same way.
Well, this is one of the spin-offs, one of the benefits, I think, for Moscow. Yes, the focus has moved away a little bit from the war on Ukraine. The other potential benefit for Moscow, and this was written again in the Russian papers today, is that there's a belief here that many of the weapons, the missiles, that perhaps would have been given or sold to Ukraine by the United States will no longer be passed on because they've been used in the Middle East. What I find interesting is that, you know, I was talking about Vladimir Putin not criticizing Donald Trump. When you hear Russian officials expressing criticism, certainly in the last few days, that's been directed at Europe, at European leaders who have criticized the idea of easing sanctions on Russia. That's where you hear Russian officials, Russian commentators being very vocal in their criticism, not so much about Donald Trump.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Well, just a little earlier this evening, I was joined from Rhode Island by one of its two Democratic senators, Jack Reed. He's a former captain in the US Army and is the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. I asked Senator Reed what he thought about the easing of sanctions on some Russian oil.
Well, it's a great gift to Russia. In fact, Russia to this point has been one of the real beneficiaries of the undeclared war against Iran. It's a situation in which they will profit significantly. And at the same time, they are reportedly providing information to the Iranians that are targeting U.S. military personnel. So this is not only wrongheaded, it's rewarding bad behavior, not good behavior.
The U.S. Treasury, you will know, would argue that this is to help U.S. consumers. It's temporary. It's only until April the 11th. It's just a temporary move.
Well, it's temporary, but the effect is significant for the Russians, the billions of dollars they will make in that time period. In addition, a collateral effect of the operations of Iran is probably to deprive Ukraine of missiles that are being exhausted now in the Middle East. So as I said, I think Russia is the winner so far in this engagement. And I don't think the Russians will view it as temporary. And unless the oil market really settles dramatically, which is not likely, even if there's some progress in Strait of Hormuz, they will extend the waivers to a lower oil prices.
I'm sure you know, but the U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said, actually, this move does not give significant financial benefit to the Russian government. He said that's because it gets the majority of its energy revenue from taxes that are assessed at the point of extraction. So he's saying it's not a huge sum of money.
Well, it's billions of dollars. A few months or years ago, we were trying to shut off all foreign sales of Russia so that they would cease their tax against the Ukrainians. And now we're saying, okay, you can trade with anyone you like. Of course, it's raising their bottom line.
Isn't this just politics in an election year? Midterms in your country later on in the year. American consumers are suffering at the petrol pumps, as we call it, the gas pumps, as you call it. And he's looking ahead to this. He doesn't want the American consumer to be penalized.
Well, I think you're right, but I again, one of the problems is they didn't look ahead before they attacked Iran. They didn't understand and realize, I think people advised them of such, that the Iranians could put pressure on oil prices, could disrupt the production facilities in the Middle East, and there would be a blowback in terms of prices. And yes, this is a very volatile issue politically in the United States. The ordinary citizen is reminded twice a week because he has to fill up the car that prices are out of control, that he can't afford the gasoline, et cetera. And if you put this together with other issues they've brought up, increasing healthcare costs, et cetera, they're in a position of vulnerability right now. They recognize that and they're trying to moderate as much as possible.
I mean, you're among those up for re-election in November. I mean, do you think this war is going to play into the campaign?
Well, I think it will. A lot of Trump's appeal to the MAGA base was stop these endless wars. Why are we investing money in these multi-billion dollars? It's been reported DOD has already spent $11 billion in the Iranian operations. That could go a long way to relieve healthcare costs, to do many other ways. And I think people get it. And it's not just the Democrats, it's the whole range of people that they're not satisfied.
Do you see an off-ramp? How does this end? How does the administration end it?
It's very difficult to end something. I think that's a lesson that history teaches over and over again. Easy to start a war, very difficult to end one. Given the behavior of President Trump before, he could walk up and say, it's over, I've won, I'm the greatest president in the world, et cetera, even though he's probably left a much more fragile and perhaps more dangerous area of the world than what he found.
Senator Jack Reed, the most senior Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Well, as promised, let's get more on the news that's been emerging in the last hour or so. Those reports that the Pentagon is planning to send thousands of Marines and more warships to the Gulf. Let's get the very latest from our correspondent, Tom Bateman, who's following this in Washington. Evening, Tom. What more do we know? What are you hearing?
Well, this is a deployment of the USS Tripoli, which is based in Japan. It is an amphibious assault ship. Alongside that would be around 5,000 troops, probably half of those US Marines. And this is a task force that is trained in things like seizing beachheads, keeping open maritime chokeholds, exactly the kind of situation, of course, that we're seeing around the Strait of Hormuz. Now, important to say, this is not a sort of formal public announcement by the Trump administration. It is being briefed tonight by administration officials. But I think it gives you a sense of what is at one end potential contingency planning because of the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz, at the other, the potential for planning to deepen and extend this war for, and to have the potential for some troops going in some areas on the ground if this was some kind of amphibious landings to secure that strait. All of it, though, a long way in the distance. They're currently based in Japan, as I say. It'd take about 2 weeks for this task force to get to the Middle East.
Yes, but as you're suggesting, so it does raise the possibility there must be discussion about whether it's ultimately boots on the ground. And what is the aim here? Is this the Trump administration hoping that somehow this move will put pressure on the regime to surrender?
Well, I think, I mean, I was in the news briefing with Defense Secretary Hegseth at the Pentagon today, and I was, you know, the administration is stung by the criticism they're getting from the parts of the US media over not appearing to have had a workable plan to quickly counter what many people have said the Iranians would do, which is to put a chokehold around the Strait of Hormuz. Now, Pete Hegseth really attacked the media and confronted them today about this, said, of course, they knew this was going to happen. Of course, there is a plan. But when he was pressed on what the plan is, apart from things they've said, like destroying mine laying ships and destroying missile arsenals, you know, the idea that they're going to get tanker traffic flowing again in the next few days is clearly not going to happen. But they are saying it is untrue. They were not planning for this. So I think this is connected certainly to trying to get the strait back open. But that is an extremely complex and dangerous thing to do. At the same time, I think briefing it out clearly is intended to put some psychological pressure on the regime, that the administration is prepared to escalate this. And that sort of feeds into what President Trump is ultimately trying to do here, which is to coerce, you know, what remains of the leadership in Tehran to do what he says.
Interesting. All right. Thanks so much. Tom Bateman there with the latest in Washington. And we will talk a little bit later in the programme, a little bit more about Iran. Right now, a pointer as to something else coming up later. Cuba's president confirmed today that officials from the island have held talks with the US government for the first time in 8 years. We'll hear from Havana about how the ailing economy is affecting ordinary people.
Friends of mine who have a terrible, terrible time. They are getting up in the middle of the night to cook because that's the only time, the 2 hours that they get electricity. The food is going off in the refrigerator. Their children can't sleep because they can't have fans when there's no electricity.
Well, much more about the situation facing people in Cuba later in the programme. Now, though, let's take a breath for a few minutes because we are nearly at the end of awards season. You might be glad about that. It's the Oscars on Sunday, as you probably know. Amidst the inevitable newspaper articles about who should win and who will win, you may have also noticed an uptick in columns questioning whether particular actors or filmmakers have blown their chances of going home with a gold statuette because of a scandal about something they've said in an interview. Timothy Chalamet, who's in the running for Best Actor in the film Marty Supreme, caused some controversy when he said this during a CNN Variety town hall event.
I admire people, and I've done it myself, to go on a talk show and go, hey, we got to keep movie theaters alive. You know, we got to keep this genre alive. And I don't want to be working in ballet or opera or, you know, things where it's like, hey, keep this thing alive, even though no one cares about this anymore. All respect to the ballet and opera people out there. I just lost 14 cents in viewership.
Bit of nervous laughter at the end there. Well, despite his good humour, there ended up being quite a howl round about his views on opera and ballet. And Jessie Buckley, considered a shoo-in really for Best Actress for playing Shakespeare's wife in Hamlet, has seen an awful lot of column inches devoted to her comments about not really being too keen on cats. She's a dog person, apparently. Well, what does all of this tell us about the campaigns that are waged by agents and film companies to try to win an Academy Award because of the career boost it can bring? Let's ask Michael Shulman, because he is author of Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat and Tears. He joins us tonight from LA. And here in London is Reina Azim, who is awards editor for the website Movie Marker. Very good evening to both of you. Michael, I'll come to you first there in California. I mean, the two examples we talked about there, I mean, frankly, they're both pretty lighthearted and silly, aren't they? Just sort of silly little comments. But it does seem that, particularly with the Timothy Chalamet thing, that it's going to be hurting his chances. What do you think?
I think this is all a sign that award season has gone on a little too long. We've run out of things to talk about, and these people have been out on the campaign trail, putting themselves in front of microphones and cameras for months and months and months. And you know, Barack Obama used to call it silly season in presidential elections. And this has been a pretty silly slate of Oscar controversies. You know, I mean, my book covers 100 years of them, and they're often about something real. These are, you know, even last year we had Carlos Sofia Gascon of, you know, Emilia Perez, who it was discovered had just been tweeting, you know, offensive stuff about basically every single group you could think of. And that really torched her chances. This year, this is sort of feels like more much ado about nothing. And I will say, although it seems that the Timothy Chalamet comments have really caused this huge backlash in the media, they started spreading really at the very end, the last day of actual voting for the Oscars. So I don't think they did much to hurt his chances. I think there was a little bit of a shift away from him already happening. And we saw that, for instance, you know, Michael B. Jordan won the Actor Award. So I feel like there might be a shift in momentum anyway. But I don't think that one comment could have ruined his chances.
All right. Interesting. I mean, Reina Azim, apparently you are out and proud Team Chalamet. So I guess you'd be quite upset if he didn't win just because of comments about opera or ballet, however much anyone may or may not like those art forms.
Well, first of all, I think he should win because of the five nominated actors he gave the best performance. I truly believed that he was Marty in that film. And I truly believe that Jessie Buckley was Agnes in Hamlet. But yes, what Timothy Chalamet said, it's not a scandal. It's not even a controversy. It's a talking point. It's a debate. And I think people have become so addicted to rage. Everything is an outrage, and it really isn't. And I am Team Chalamet, but I think it's great that he said something interesting that he genuinely seemed to believe, instead of the very safe, bland answers that so many actors give. And I totally agree with what Michael has said. Awards season seems to last the entire year now. It starts in May at Cannes, and then it goes on this time until March. That's almost pretty much the whole year. And I've seen actors, and I'm sure Michael has as well, at press conferences and festivals, and they're terrified if they're in the running for an award of saying anything interesting. And so they always end up saying something boring. And I think that actually affects the Oscars, because everyone knows what an Oscar is and how big a thing it is to win it. But the Oscars are losing steam. And I love the Oscars, and it saddens me to say that. But people, you know, do people care as much now who wins? Who can name who won 3 years ago? What they remember are the memorable moments.
Yes.
And sometimes that memorable moment might be, you know, someone crying when they've won, or making a genuinely sweet speech, or making a great speech. And I think Timothy Chalamet actually would make a great speech when he wins.
When he wins. We'll find out on Sunday. I mean, a similar question to both of you, really. Raina, I mean, we're talking about relatively frivolous things this year, as I think you're both reflecting. But, I mean, there have been times, haven't they, where Oscar campaigns have been quite political, quite dirty. I mean, Raina, your thoughts on that, first of all?
I agree. I read somewhere that even during the Weinstein era, and we know how that ended, that they were spending something like $8 million on campaigns. And I always watch the campaigns, because suddenly something scandalous will come out about someone's past. And you think it's not really relevant to whether they gave a great performance or not, but it's there in the media. And it's there, I'm sure, to sully and tarnish their chances of winning. And I think that is wrong. And I think it's very sad. And I'm sure Michael knows a lot about that, because he's obviously written a book about it.
Well, yes.
But yes, there have been scandals, but I don't think we have a scandal this year.
Yeah, interesting. And Michael, what sort of stories did you dig up with your book?
Oh, I mean, I could bring you back to like 1942 when, you know, William Randolph Hearst and basically all of Hollywood ganged up on Citizen Kane because it was an expose of the Hearst media empire. And, you know, on Oscar night, the movie lost all but one Oscar. I don't think Oscar controversy is anything new. And, you know, sometimes they can bring up real issues, you know, like, for instance, like the Brokeback Mountain, like the year that lost to Crash, which is still gets people going because it's such a wrong decision.
Yes, don't start me on that.
Exactly. But, you know, we were hearing at the time from older Academy members who just didn't feel right voting for this gay cowboy movie. And, you know, so Oscar campaigns, you know, Oscar races can be flashpoints for where the culture is and, you know, what people do or don't want to throw their weight behind.
Okay.
It's also it's sort of a Oscar campaigning is a little bit of a paradox, because these actors have to be on the campaign trail promoting themselves for months, but they can't just say, I want the Oscar. They have to come up with other stuff to talk about, because you're not supposed to be campaigning for an Oscar. And so people talk about it, you know, anything else. They're constantly doing media, but the media is not really about what this is about, which is trying to win over Oscar voters. And so that's okay. Where I think you have some of these things like
interesting
pop up.
So thanks so much to both of you. Thank you. Enjoy Sunday's ceremony if you can. Michael Shulman, Raina Azim, thank you very much indeed. Just a reminder of the headlines here on The World Tonight. Media reports in the US suggest the Pentagon is preparing to send reinforcements to the Middle East, including thousands of troops who could be used for ground operations. Oil prices have remained above $100 a barrel. European leaders have criticised the White House decision to ease some sanctions on Russian oil, and President Zelensky warns that won't help bring peace to Ukraine. And a photo showing Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, Lord Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein on the same photo has been discovered for the first time. Now, as promised, we will return our attentions to the situation in Iran, in the Middle East. The US-Israel war entering its third week in Iran, of course, tomorrow. And about 1,000 Iranians a day are making the journey to cross to southeastern Turkey to leave their country. You might have heard our correspondent Dan Johnson last night. He was talking to people as they got off the train in Van near the Iran-Turkey border. Dan's been in the border area for the last week, and he's been speaking to a 30-year-old Iranian who actually lives in the north of England and works here for the NHS. She was visiting family in Iran a week before the conflict began. You will hear her voice talking to Dan, but she's requested that we don't use her name for fear of reprisals.
So when the war starts for the first day, people were happy. I was in the streets and I myself was smiling, even though that would put my flight back home in danger. So everyone was out. People were shouting with happiness, yelling and circling and saying yay and stuff. And everyone was like clapping. It was a really memorable night for me. And after that, the pro-government team started turning around the streets every night with Islamic Republic flags. And people just look at them, even mocking them. But because they're afraid that they get killed again, they can't say anything.
Are you surprised then that the conflict has gone on, and even after the Ayatollah was killed, it seems like very little has changed yet?
I thought they will collapse sooner. But now we understand that maybe Khamenei was just a mask, was just maybe a puppet for the IRGC. But, you know, I think that part that they start sending rockets and attacking their neighbors is like a sign that shows that they're not very organized now.
What do you think should happen next?
I don't want more innocent people to be dead. I don't want more cost on the shoulders of my country anymore. If the Islamic Republic remains after this war, I'm afraid that things get harder for my people, more restricted by the Islamic Republic. You can see that they have blocked the internet. Even now that I'm here, there's no way for me to contact my parents.
Do you think then there's any way the regime can survive long term?
They can control 90 million people, especially when more than half of them are against them, against their rules. They can control every room. They can control every house. People have their undercover lives. People are dancing without any scarves. People are drinking alcohol. People are living their life. Our people have tried many times. They get killed. They get arrested. We can't do anything about it. We are not that powerful. But we need the world's help.
And do your friends, your family all feel the same?
99% of them, yeah. Even some people that were pro-Islamic Republic, after what they did in January, they're against them because people witness what they did.
What do you want people back in the UK to understand?
I heard from my British friends at work or at different places that they think that Khamenei is the one who stood against Israel and USA. He's so powerful, he's brave. He's not. He and his regime is just, they're crazy. I don't know. They're just following some mad rules, mad religious rules. And I want the world to know that governments of Iran and Iranian people are two different worlds. If you are pro-Khamenei, you are pro-IRGC, you are so wrong. They don't have mercy. They don't like freedom. They don't like beautiful things. Even though people are so creative, are so brave, are so energetic and beautiful, they try to suppress them. Have you read Harry Potter? They're like some creatures, I forgot the name. They suck the happiness from people's souls. This is what IRGC do to my people. I hope that my country get back to the freedom as soon as possible. We really need a change. My people can't take it anymore, I think.
One young Iranian woman talking to Dan Johnson on the Iran-Turkey border. Well, earlier in the conflict, you'll remember President Trump called the Prime Minister Keir Starmer no Winston Churchill after the government refused to allow the use of UK bases for the initial strikes on Iran. The US had wanted to use the military base in Diego Garcia, but the Prime Minister refused, only agreeing to the request to use military bases subsequently for defensive strikes on Iranian missile sites. So what is public opinion here in the UK about this continuing war and whether we should be involved? Let's ask Patrick English from YouGov. He is head of elections and political and social data there. Hello, Patrick. Very good evening. Good to have you with us. You've been polling for a number of weeks about the war in Iran. What do the results show?
Well, good evening. Thank you for having me. Yes, the results really are quite clear. The British public are not supportive at all of the UK joining in any sense the military action against Iran. Only 8% of the public think that we should join the conflict as the US and Israel are engaged in it right now. 46% do support defensive action only. But even if we look at sort of issues around using UK bases for strikes against, even if we say sort of missile defences in Iran or missile attacks rather than Iran, the British public are simply against this. So In the round, what the British public are saying to us right now is that they do not support Britain getting involved at all in military action against Iran. They're very wary of any conflict at all, to be honest. And that's rather in the round what they're saying to us right now.
Okay, that's interesting. So not in favour, and yet we know we talk a lot about difficult opinion polling, can I put it that way, for yes. Keir Starmer. So are you picking up that people broadly think this is something he's getting right?
That's a very interesting question. Like, opposition to the conflict rose to 59% among the public this week, and that was up 10 points on the previous week. And even though the government is quite aligned with where the British public are right now, we tend to find that Keir Starmer is not getting the benefit of that in the court of public opinion. 47% say that he has handled the conflict badly, 34% think well, 52% think that he is handling the relationship with Trump badly, and 34% think well. So even though that the government and Keir Starmer are quite well aligned with where the British public are in regards to the conflict and what they think that the UK's response should be to it, they still are more likely to say that the British government is handling that relationship and Keir Starmer is handling that relationship and that conflict badly. Although it is worth saying, though that 34% on both metrics is quite low, and certainly lower than the respondents who think that this is being handled badly, that is higher than when we ask about stuff like cost of living or immigration. We tend to see sort of 10 to 20% saying that they're handling that well. So there is still some sort of dynamic in which the British public is saying, yes, the government are handling this perhaps better than some domestic issues, which is actually quite common regarding judgments of this Labour government and Keir Starmer. But overall, they're more likely to say that they're handling this badly. And that's sort of, some people are saying that Keir Starmer and the government have a reverse Midas touch on these things. And perhaps that's in play now, that even though they are quite closely aligned with what the public want the British state to do, they still think that the government is handling this issue badly.
Patrick English, thank you so much from YouGov. Thanks for your time. Now, there was a significant announcement on Cuban national television today.
In those talks, we have expressed our willingness to continue the process under the principles of equality and respect for the political systems of both countries. That's the moment we're in now in relation to dialogue with the United States.
That was President Miguel Díaz-Canel confirming talks between Cuban officials and the US government. The countries have had frosty relations since Fidel Castro's revolution 70 years ago. But since then, changes in the Cuban regime and the impact of US sanctions on the country appears to have resulted in a thaw. The US embargo has choked off oil supplies, triggering a severe energy crisis on the island nation. Ruri Nickel is The Guardian's man in Havana. He's lived there for more than 8 years, and he's been explaining what these talks might mean and what life is like there at the moment.
The US State Department has been leaking about these talks for quite some time, weeks now, but the Cuban government has either said that they weren't happening beyond the usual discussions or just has batted away questions. Finally, the Cuban government have said that these talks are occurring, which is a major moment. However, there is disquiet, I would say, among Cubans, because that is all they've said. There has been no explanation about what a plan might be. And the situation on the streets in Cuba is getting worse by the day now, as Cuba sort of sits under what is nearly a month, well, is a month long US oil blockade.
Yes. Well, talk to us a little bit about the problems that people are facing.
You have to put this in context of the fact that the Cuban government has been bankrupt for several years now since the pandemic. This is a communist state. People were used to being able to go to the bodega, get their ration of beans, rice, etc., etc. That has now pretty much disappeared. The bodegas are emptying. There has been increasing problems with electricity supply. There is rolling blackouts, but there's also been a sort of countrywide blackouts. The system is very antiquated. Blackouts means the water doesn't come in. It means they can't sleep at night because there's no fans. It means the food, which is very expensive for most people, goes off in their refrigerator. The cars have stopped running. There's no gas. The state offices have closed. The power cuts have become very much worse. Friends of mine who have a terrible, terrible time. They are getting up in the middle of the night to cook because that's the only time, the 2 hours that they get electricity.
The food is going off in the refrigerator. The children of a friend of mine were sent back from school the other day because there is no gas, so they can't cook on gas. So they were cooking on wood, and it had rained, and the wood got wet. So then suddenly she, who's a professor, had her children back with her because they couldn't feed the kids at school. And they're dealing with it day after day after day, and it's grinding them down. People are exhausted. The situation could get very bad indeed. And by that, I mean starvation, I mean disease.
It really is that bad?
It's not at the moment. There's food in the shops. But again, because of the economy being in tatters, there's been hyperinflation for the last few years. So if you work for the state, which is about half the people, or you're on a state pension, which affects an awful lot of people, then those have been reduced to between $5 and $10 a month. Now, the new shops that have appeared as the bodegas sort of retreated sell food, but, you know, a bag of beans could be $3. If you're getting $5 a month, that's a disaster.
So when people hear today that there have been talks, regular people's priority is to get some normality. That has to be their priority above anything, surely. What would they want from any of these talks?
Well, they want change. They want a situation where they just want to be able to, you know, have enough money to buy things or get things and feed their children. What I now hear from most Cubans is, I really don't care who's to blame. Can somebody give us a break? Something I noticed, the protests, the little protests, and even the biggest one that happened in July 2021 here, they all started with mothers with babies who were so desperate they went to some local government office to ask for help. And because they went, other people got involved, and then these little protests began. People have lived with this government for a long time, so they don't want to protest. And so people have to be desperate to do so. And usually that's mothers with small kids. Wow. So, yes, it's bad.
That's really interesting. I mean, Marco Rubio has said he wants regime change, hasn't he? Is it possible to gauge what the ordinary person, to use that phrase, would want? I hear you that they want to be able to feed their families. Would they take a view on regime change?
I've not yet heard a Cuban say to me that they want the Americans to come in. That just doesn't happen, except lately in jokes. I've begun to hear it in jokes. But on the whole, Cubans here certainly don't want some sort of armed invasion. They would like to see market reforms. They'd like to see some sort of economic reforms. There hasn't been democracy in this country for a long time. So you start talking in those terms and people, they do say, I'd like to get some powdered milk for my kid. That's what they will reply to you.
Rory Nicol from The Guardian in Havana there. Just time for our closing headlines. The White House is understood to be preparing to send reinforcements to the Middle East, with US media reporting that could include thousands of Marines. And it could allow American forces to conduct ground operations, including reopening the Strait of Hormuz to commercial shipping. That is The World Tonight. I'm Jane Hill. From me and everyone on the team, have a lovely weekend.
You too, Jane. Studio direction was by Pat Sissons. The editor was Ellen Otson.